The Speeches and Acts by Simon J. Kistemaker, Criswell Theological Review, Volume 5.1, 1990, pages 31 to 41. About half of the book of Acts consists of speeches, discourses, and letters. Counting both the short and long addresses, we number at least 26 speeches that are made by either apostles and Christian leaders or by non-Christians, Jews and Gentiles. Classifying these speeches, we have 8 addresses delivered by Peter, a lengthy sermon by Stephen before the Sanhedrin in chapter 7, verses 2 to 53, a brief explanation by Cornelius, chapter 10, verses 30 to 33, a short address by James at the Jerusalem Council, chapter 15, verses 13 through 21, the advice of Paul by James and the elders in Jerusalem, chapter 21, verses 20 to 25, and 9 sermons and speeches by Paul. The rest of the discourses were given by Gamaliel the Pharisee, chapter 5, verses 35 to 39, Demetrius the silversmith, chapter 19, verses 25 to 27, the city clerk in Ephesus, chapter 19, verse 35 to 40, Tertullus the lawyer, chapter 24, verses 2 through 8, and Festus the governor, chapter 25, verses 24 to 27. In addition, Luke relays the text of 2 letters, one from the Jerusalem Council to the Gentile churches, chapter 15, verses 23 to 29, and the other by Claudius Lysias, addressed to Governor Felix, chapter 23, verses 27 to 30. 1. Sources. The speeches in Acts make the book interesting, because when people talk, we learn something about their personalities. Luke gives the reader an opportunity to listen to the speakers, and by listening to come to know their personalities. Luke was personally present when Paul addressed the Ephesian elders, spoke in Jerusalem, defended himself before Felix, and delivered speeches before Festus and Agrippa. We presume that Luke received from Paul the wording of Paul's sermon in Pisidian Antioch and his Areopagus address. Perhaps Paul and other witnesses provided information on Stephen's speech before the Sanhedrin. From Peter, Luke gathered material on the addresses of Peter in the upper room, at Pentecost, near Solomon's colonnade, before the Sanhedrin, and at the Jerusalem Council. And from James, he received the details concerning the Jerusalem Council. If Luke collected his material from eyewitnesses, does he faithfully reproduce the speeches which they and others made? As can be expected, the context reveals that Luke presents the addresses in summary form. But are these summaries true to fact, or have they been placed in the mouths of the speakers? Some scholars are of the opinion that the speeches are the creation of the writer of Acts. By comparison, they point to the Greek historian Thucydides, and claim that Luke adopted the methodology of Thucydides. This historian declared in composing his speeches he, quote, adhered as closely as possible to the general sense of what was actually said, end quote. The apparent intention of this ancient writer was to state that the speeches he wrote were historically accurate and not based on his own imagination. Even though the words of Thucydides have been a topic of much debate, the inclination to take his sayings at face value prevails. The task which the ancient historian assumed was to give an account of the events just as they happened. He reported facts, not fiction. If we listen to Luke's own words in the preface to his gospel, we learn that he gives an account of the things that have happened and which people have accepted as true. Luke 1:1, compare Acts 1:1. Thus, at the beginning of his writings, Luke informs the reader that his reporting as a historian is true to fact. 2. History. The question that concerns the student of Acts is whether Luke is giving a truthful presentation in his historical account. Does he accurately report the speeches he himself did not hear? Before we can examine some speeches in Acts, Let us first note that Luke's reporting reflects linguistic peculiarities that show the area and setting in which the dialogue took place. In many sections of his Gospel and Acts, Luke expresses himself in excellent Greek. This is evident, for instance, from the Greek in the introduction to his Gospel, Luke chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. But throughout the birth narratives, Luke 1 and 2, his diction and word choice bear a distinct Aramaic stamp. It is as if Mary herself relates to Luke the accounts of Jesus' conception and birth in Aramaic Greek. Indeed, so Luke reports, Mary kept all these things in her heart, chapter 2, verses 19 and 51. Also in Acts, Luke varies the choice of words with reference to the locale. He reflects the diction, vocabulary, and culture of the area he describes. In the chapters that depict Palestine, chapters 1 through 15, Luke's Greek has an Aramaic coloring. The second half of the book, chapter 16 to 28, reflects a Gentile setting and is written in more fluent Greek that, at times, rivals classical Greek. To illustrate, of the 67 times that the optative mood occurs in the New Testament, 17 of these are in Acts. Of these, 17 instances appear mostly in the second half of the book, and often come from speakers who knew Greek well. Another aspect of a Jewish backdrop that Luke portrays in Acts is the use of Semiticisms. For instance, Jesus addresses Paul on the way to Damascus with the Hebrew name Saul, instead of the Grecized form Saulos, chapter 9, verse 4, 22, verse 7, 26, verse 14, and see chapter 9, verse 17, 22, verse 13. By contrast, when Governor Festus alludes to Emperor Nero as Ha Sebastas and Ha Kurios, chapter 25, verses 25 and 26, he exposes a typical Roman setting. Is Luke composing speeches that he places on the lips of the speakers, or does he present more or less the exact words of the speakers uttered in summarized form? If we say that Luke is the source for these speeches, he proves to be an exceptionally skilled artist who writes a masterful book with all the possible nuances of speech and word choice. His work, then, is closer to fiction than history. But if we contend that Luke's source material comes directly from the speakers or the community that heard them, he mirrors people as they are with their own peculiarities and characteristics. Quote, the question of historicity of the speeches is not beside the point in the study of the work which claims to be a historical narrative. End quote. Luke, then, is both a writer and a historian. Space does not permit examination of all the discourses in Acts. We must be selective and refer to only a few, namely those of Stephen, Peter, and Paul, with a passing reference to those of Tertullus and Festus. In the last part of Acts, chapter 20 to 28, Luke discloses that he himself was present and, therefore, he speaks as an eyewitness. 3. Stephen. The most extensive speech in Acts is the one Stephen delivered before the members of the Sanhedrin, chapter 7, verses 2 through 53. Stephen traces the history of the people of Israel from the time of Abraham to that of Solomon's temple. But the speech is much more than a chronicle of historical events. Stephen imparts that he is an expert theologian who is thoroughly acquainted with the scriptures. He is knowledgeable in drawing implicit conclusions and displays the same theological acumen as the writer of the Epistle of Hebrews unveils. Stephen directly quotes no less than 15 Old Testament passages, of which 13 are from the Pentateuch and 2 from the prophets. Of the 40 Old Testament quotations cited in Acts 15 are in Stephen's speech. The repeated appeal to the Old Testament is not a characteristic of Luke's style, but rather points to a theologian of Stephen's stature, chapter 6, verses 9 through 10. Moreover, Stephen has selected considerable detail from the primary events of Israel's early history. Quote, "The major events and details which are included are carefully chosen and presented to indicate convincingly the accuracy of Stephen's interpretation of Israel's past history. In his speech, Stephen shows that God is not bound to an earthly temple built by human hands. God revealed himself to Abraham in Mesopotamia, to Joseph in Egypt, and to Moses in the flames of the burning bush. Stephen proves that the Jews are unable to confine God's dwelling place to the temple in Jerusalem. He develops the theological themes of God, worship, the law, the covenant, and the person and message of the Messiah. Through the work of the Messiah, the house of Israel is able to worship God in truth and justice. Stephen avoids mentioning the name of Jesus, but teaches that God has raised up a Savior for the house of Israel. We are unable to ascertain from whom Luke received the substance of Stephen's speech. We surmise that Luke gained access to the speech that Stephen delivered before the Sanhedrin from Paul and those members of the Sanhedrin who later became Christians. The speech came to Luke's attention through a fixed tradition, either in oral or written form. With reference to Acts 7, a study of word choice, references to the temple and to Moses, and the absence of typical Lucan constructions, all these facts indicate that Stephen's speech did not originate in the mind of Luke. Thus, the words promise and affliction have their own significance in the context of Acts 7 and do not correspond to their usages in the rest of Acts. Next, Stephen's manner of speaking about Moses in the temple is confined to this particular discourse. Luke writes nowhere else in Acts in a similar manner. And last, in Stephen's speech, are at least 23 words that do not occur again either in Acts or in any other book in the New Testament. Also, numerous literary forms peculiar to both the Gospel of Luke and Acts are absent from Stephen's speech. We cannot assume that Luke has presented a verbatim account of Stephen's speech, but we confidently assert that he allows the original speaker to be heard in words and concepts that belong to Stephen, the first Christian martyr. We infer that as a faithful historian, Luke has incorporated the discourse of Stephen at this juncture of Acts to prepare the reader for the persecution subsequent to Stephen's death and for extending the church beyond the confines of Jerusalem. It was Stephen and not Luke who provided the impetus to further the church's development. Luke, therefore, is reporting factual information based on historical events. He is a historian who, in the manner of Thucydides, reports speeches as closely as possible to the general sense of what the speakers actually said. 4. Peter. Peter's Pentecost sermon is the first of three major addresses Peter delivered, chapter 2, verses 14 through 36, chapter 3, verses 12 through 26, chapter 10, verses 34 to 43. Some scholars are of the opinion that Peter's Pentecost sermon is much more a theological discourse written by Luke than a historical report of the apostle's speech. We know that Luke himself was not present in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost, but that he received his information from, quote, eyewitnesses and servants of the word, Luke chapter 1, verse 2. We presume that Peter served as Luke's informant who gave him the pattern and wording of the sermon. In fact, quote, both the pattern and the basic theology are older than Luke and probably reach back into the early days of the church, end quote. Luke presents a summary of Peter's sermon, which is also the case in the other discourses. Luke indicates that much more was said, for Peter warned the people with many other words, chapter 2, verse 40. In his speeches, Peter employs concepts that have an echo in his epistles. He even exhibits similarities in his word choice. Comparing these similarities in both his speeches and letters, we find some instances that are striking not only in Greek, but even in translation. In Acts, For example, quote, by the set purpose and foreknowledge of God, chapter 2, verse 23, compare 1 Peter, according to the foreknowledge of God, 1 Peter 1, verse 2. Acts chapter 3, 6, silver or gold I do not have, compare with 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 18, such as silver or gold that you are were redeemed. Acts chapter 3, verse 16, the faith that comes through him. Compare 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 21, you believe in God through him. Acts chapter 10, verse 42, as judge of the living and the dead. Compare to 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 5, to judge the living and the dead. When Peter addresses the household of Cornelius, he tells the Gentile audience that, quote, God shows no favoritism, end quote, chapter 10, verse 34. Next, he repeats his thought in slightly different wording when he speaks at the Jerusalem Council in favor of admitting Gentiles to membership in the church. He says that God, quote, made no distinction between us and them, end quote, chapter 15, verse 9. Third, in 1 Peter, he writes that God, quote, impartially judges each man's work, end quote, chapter 1, verse 17. At last, when Peter proclaims the good news to the crowd at Solomon's colonnade, he instructs the people to repent in order to hasten the coming of the Christ, chapter 3, verses 19 through 21. He expresses the same sentiment in a brief sentence in 2 Peter. He writes, quote, you ought to live holy and godly lives as you look forward to the day of God and speed its coming, end quote, chapter 3, 11b through 12a, NIV. We admit that all these resemblances are no more than proverbial straws in the wind. Nevertheless, these similarities point in the same direction and lend verbal support to the historicity of Peter's discourses. These speeches, Peter clearly teaches both the humanity and divinity of Jesus Christ. For example, chapter 2, verse 22, and verses 33 to 36. Also, throughout his writings, Peter refers to Jesus as God and man. For example, 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 2, and verse 3, and chapter 2, verse 21 and 24, chapter 3, verse 15, and 2 Peter 1, 1. In brief, Peter represents Jesus Christ as God and man in both his addresses and epistles. 5. Paul. Luke has recorded three of Paul's missionary discourses: the synagogue sermon in Pisidian Antioch, chapter 13, verses 16 to 41, the Areopagus speech in Athens, chapter 17, verses 22 to 31, and the farewell address to the Ephesian elders in chapter 20, verses 18 through 35. Of these three, Luke personally heard the third one. He appears to have received information on the first two discourses from Paul and his travel companions. The Pisidian Antioch sermon is a type that Paul delivered throughout Asia Minor, Macedonia, and Greece. Compare chapter 14, verses 15 to 17, and chapter 17, verses 22 to 31. Paul's sermon basically consists of three parts. 1. A survey of Israel's history. 2. The life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. And 3. The application of the gospel message. Many aspects of this sermon resemble features in the sermon delivered by Peter in Jerusalem, chapter 2, verses 14 to 36, and chapter 3, verses 12 to 26, and the one Stephen preached before the Sanhedrin, chapter 7, verses 2 through 53. Paul's sermon in Pisidian Antioch discloses aspects of his epistolatory teaching. When Paul preached in the synagogue at Antioch, he ended his sermon by mentioning the doctrine of justification. He said, quote, everyone who believes in Jesus is justified from all things from which you could not be justified through the law of Moses, end quote. Chapter 13, verse 39. There is a discernible link between his sermon and his epistles, for Paul expresses the doctrine of justification in his epistles to the Romans, the Galatians, and the Ephesians. This fundamental tenet he taught both in sermons and letters. Strictly speaking, Paul's Areopagus address in Athens is not a defense of the Christian faith. Rather, his speech is both a challenge to the pagan religion and a proclamation of the gospel. Paul stood before the members of the Areopagus Council. He faced an audience that was different from that of the synagogue worship services. In the presence of the Athenian philosophers, he could not assume that they had any knowledge of the scriptures or of Jesus who fulfilled scriptural prophecies. Paul had to begin his speech by teaching his audience the doctrines of God and creation. He continued his teaching with the doctrine of man, for man is God's offspring. He concluded his oration with the doctrines of judgment and resurrection. We affirm the historicity of Paul's visit to the council of the Areopagus. In that meeting, Paul, the apostle to the Gentiles, introduced a pagan audience to the teachings of the Christian faith. He commented that God created man, appointed a day for judgment, and overlooked man's sins of the past. Paul's speech and writing reveal similarity. In his letter to the Romans, Paul mentions that God has made himself known in creation, that God judges men's secrets through Jesus Christ, and that God has shown his forbearance by leaving his sins unpunished. Romans chapter 1, verses 19 to 21, chapter 2, verse 16, chapter 3, 21 through 26. Comparing these comments with his Areopagus address, we assert that Paul himself addressed the council members of the Areopagus. We assume that at a later time he gave Luke the wording of his speech. Even though Paul alludes to an altar inscription, quote, to the unknown God, end quote, and quotes some lines from pagan sources, he nowhere indicates that the gospel occupies common ground with pagan religion and philosophy, end quote. Paul uses these pagan aspects as points of contact with his audience, but refuses to accommodate and compromise the gospel message. In this respect, he is true to his God, who gives man the law not to have any gods before him. When Paul refers to pagan gods, he skillfully employs the neuter gender. What? Ha! Therefore you worship in ignorance this, tuta, I am proclaiming to you, end quote. Chapter 17, verse 23. And we, in ignorance, this, tuta, and, quote, we ought not to think that the divine being, ta telon, is like an image, end quote. Chapter 17, verse 29. He refrains from calling an idol, quote, God, end quote, but classifies it with impersonal objects. Conclusively, Luke indicates that Paul carefully chose his words when he addressed the Athenian philosophers. Paul's farewell address to the Ephesian elders on the beach of Miletus has a number of phrases that occur in his epistles. These are a few illustrations. Acts chapter 20, verse 19, serving the Lord with all humility. Compare serving the Lord from Romans 12, 11, with all humility from Ephesians 4, 2. Acts chapter 20, verse 24, that I may finish the race. Compare to 2 Timothy 4, 7, I have finished the race. Acts chapter 20, verse 24, complete the task I received from the Lord. Compare that to Colossians chapter 4, verse 17, complete the task you received in the Lord. In examining the diction of Paul's farewell speech, R. H. Charles concludes, quote, there is every ground for accepting this speech as trustworthy record of Paul's speech. Some of the phrases are exclusively Pauline, as plain hati kai nu idu desma kai flipsais nuthetain. Others are characteristically Pauline and non-Lucan, as me phaedasthai tape phronsunes hupastelestai nukta kai hemera ta sumferon. In view of Luke's presence, we confidently affirm the historicity of Paul's speech recorded by his friend Luke. C.K. Barrett pointedly asks why Luke would write fiction and attach the story to Miletus instead of, quote, the great city and Pauline center, Ephesus, end quote. If Luke records a historical event, then the address is an eyewitness report that reflects the words Paul spoke. The speeches which Paul the prisoner delivered before the Jews in Jerusalem, chapter 22, verses 1 to 21, and before King Agrippa, chapter 26, verses 2 to 29, exhibit remarkable differences, even though both contain the account of Paul's conversion experience. For one thing, the audiences are different. In his Jerusalem address, Paul never mentions the name Jesus, with the exception of Jesus' self-identification, chapter 22, verse 8. Paul purposely circumscribes the name to avoid giving offense to his Jewish audience. But when he addresses King Agrippa and tries to persuade him to believe in Jesus, he explicitly mentions Jesus' name, chapter 26, verse 9. Further addressing the Jews in Jerusalem, Paul features Ananias as a devout man according to the law and respected by all the Jews living in Damascus, chapter 22, verse 12. In his speech before Agrippa, Paul overlooks the entire encounter with Ananias because it detracts from his purpose to acquaint the king with the gospel. He delivers his Jerusalem address in Hebrew or Aramaic, chapter 21, verse 40, but his discourse before Agrippa and Festus in excellent Greek. In the presence of these government officials, military commanders, and prominent citizens of Caesarea, Paul's diction compares with that of classical Greek. To illustrate, he employs an Attic verb form, isasi, instead of the third-person plural, oidasin, chapter 26, verse 4. He ingeniously quotes the words, quote, nothing was done secretly in a corner, end quote, chapter 26, verse 26, which philosophers pejoratively used for uneducated teachers. He uses the optative mood in his closing remark to Agrippa, Euxaimein an, chapter 26, verse 29. What are these characteristics that support the historicity of Paul's speech before King Agrippa? In summary, here are the highlights. First, no speech, either of Paul or any other speaker in Acts, is as personal in tone as Paul's address before Agrippa. See especially verse 27. This speech sparkles in the beauty of its direct gospel appeal. Paul speaks engagingly to King Agrippa throughout his discourse by addressing him by title, name, and personal pronoun, you. Next, Paul fits his choice of words to the class of his audience. That is, his diction and syntax are approaching classical Greek and equal that of his Areopagus address, chapter 17, verses 22 to 31. At the same time, we hear in his Agrippa speech the same tone and tenor of Paul's other discourses. Third, in his speech before Agrippa, Paul repeats his conversion experience, chapter 22, verses 1 through 21, C&C, chapter 9, verses 1 to 19. Although the three conversion accounts reveal differences, Paul freely selects from his own recollection those elements that suit his present purposes. And because Paul is the speaker, he is free to choose his own wording to describe the event. Last, Paul addresses Agrippa, who is of Jewish descent, and, as curator of Jerusalem temple, as, quote, an expert in all the customs and disputes of the Jews, end quote, chapter 26, verse 3, yet Paul's speech is not a one-sided gospel appeal directed only to Agrippa. See, for instance, verse 8. He presents the doctrine of Christ's resurrection as a light both to the Jewish people and to the Gentiles, verse 23. 6. Conclusion. The speeches in Acts accurately portray the speakers and reflect their individual traits. The syntax in some of Peter's speeches is awkward, and in some of the verses, disjointed. For example, before Cornelius and his household, Peter literally said, quote, the word which he sent to the sons of Israel, preaching peace through Jesus Christ, this one is Lord of all. You yourselves know the thing which took place throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee after the baptism which John proclaimed, end quote, chapter 10, verses 36 to 37. Tertullus, the lawyer, attempts to influence Governor Felix with flattery. Luke, who is present at the hearing, records Tertullus's grammatical errors with journalistic accuracy. The orator utters a participle, quote, finding this man to be a troublemaker, end quote, chapter 24, verse 2, instead of a main verb, and thus he disrupts the flow of the sentence. The letter from the hand of the commander, Claudius Lysias, is written in military style, chapter 23, verses 26 through 30, while the diction and syntax of Governor Festus characterize him as an educated Roman official who is able to speak excellent Greek, chapter 25, verses 24 to 27. Although Luke is the writer of the speeches and Acts, he is not their composer. That is, he does not create discourses which he places in the mouths of speakers. He himself asserts, quote, I myself have accurately investigated everything from the beginning, end quote. Luke chapter 1, verse 3. See also Acts chapter 1, 1. Hence, we are assured that Luke's presentations are based on factual and faithful research. Luke presented the people as they were, precisely because they were personally acquainted with most of them. As a travel companion of Paul, he recorded the historical events relating to Paul's words and deeds. A close examination of Paul's speeches to the Jews shows that, quote, there is much in the content that is not essentially Lucan, end quote. As he addressed Jewish audiences, Paul regularly appealed to the Old Testament scriptures, but this characteristic does not fit Luke's style. Also, much of the content and vocabulary of Stephen's speech is not repeated in the rest of Acts. This feature indicates that Luke is reporting and not composing Stephen's address. We conclude, then, that the speeches in Acts do not appear to be Lucan creations.